I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today on Midday, what will it take for cities like Baltimore to bounce back, not only from the ravages of the coronavirus pandemic, but from the problems that have plagued many mid-size American urban centers for years prior to COVID-19? Mac McComas of the Johns Hopkins 21st Century Cities Initiative is a co-author of a new book called Unlocking the Potential of Post-Industrial Cities. He joins me to talk about a roadmap for a comeback. Plus, Ethan McLeod and Melody Simmons of the Baltimore Business Journal discuss some of the development projects that are underway in Baltimore that may bring hope to underserved communities. And Leatrice Gant, a co-organizer of Baltimore Ceasefire 365, reflects on the latest ceasefire weekend. That's coming up on Midday after the news. And good afternoon. Welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Hope you had a great weekend. Thanks so much for being with us today. We're going to begin with a conversation about a new book that looks at the challenges facing six cities: Baltimore, Cleveland, Detroit, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and St. Louis. How do the challenges that these urban centers have to deal with differ from those of larger cities like New York or Los Angeles? The U.S. population has increased only slightly in recent years, but over the last 50 years, the overall U.S. population grew more than 50%. The citizenry of these six cities, however, shrunk more than 38%. Are these cities poised for a comeback? And if so, what will the drivers of that comeback be? Mac McComas joins me, along with Matthew Kahn. He is the author of Unlocking the Potential of Post-Industrial Cities. Mac is the Senior Program Manager for the Johns Hopkins University 21st Century Cities Initiative, and full disclosure, he is also a member of the WIPR Board of Directors. He joins us from his home this afternoon. Mac, welcome to the show. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
So why these six cities? Again, Baltimore, Cleveland, Detroit, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and St. Louis. What's the common thread?
So we really wanted to focus in on Baltimore because that's where we're located. That's where Johns Hopkins is located. Done a lot of research on Baltimore, but we didn't want this just to be a book about Baltimore. We wanted to look at the experience of other similar cities that have struggled with high rates of poverty and crime in recent years and population loss. So we wanted to look at sort of similar cities that had undergone loss of manufacturing jobs and had some commonalities throughout them.
And as I mentioned, generally speaking, over the last half century, the U.S. population has grown more than 50%. But in all of the cities that you studied, and particularly here in Baltimore, we're well aware of the fact that the population is shrinking. The school-age population, the number of kids in the city school system, is much less than it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Are the reasons for that here in Baltimore the same as the reasons that people in Cleveland, Detroit, Philly, Pittsburgh, and St. Louis are also experiencing?
Yeah, so a lot of it has to do with the loss of manufacturing jobs in a lot of these cities. And so, you know, folks will know that steel was huge in Pittsburgh, that car manufacturing was big in Detroit. And it really centered those cities' economies back in the 1960s. But since the 1960s, Baltimore has lost 89% of its manufacturing jobs, which, you know, during the same time period, the U.S. also lost manufacturing jobs, but it was only 35%. So, in part, it was because these cities were so heavily dependent on manufacturing in a select few industries that they were particularly hit hard by deindustrialization.
You talk about a four-dimension coordination failure. What things need to be coordinated, and how has that failure manifested itself in Baltimore and the other places that you looked at?
So really the book focuses on what investments need to be made in these cities in order for a comeback to happen. And we're honest that we both don't know the answer, but also that there's no sort of silver bullet of one policy or one program or one intervention that if that happened in any of these cities, then those cities would make a comeback. So really we center on sort of four pillars of investment. Generally speaking, investing in people, so both young and old people, investing in neighborhoods and places and real estate, investing in businesses, and investing in government.
So part of that is from the public sector, right? Part of that is from the private sector. So when you talk about, you know, the four dimensions of failure here, the failure has happened on both sides of the ledger, right? It's not just that the government has screwed this up or that private industry has ignored, long ignored neighborhoods, long ignored communities. This is how do you assess the blame sharing here? I mean, in terms of moving forward.
Yeah, so you're definitely right that it's been, it's not all on local governments, and it's not all on, you know, one business leaving the city. It's about the coordination of all these activities and the idea that, you know, if a local government makes an investment in one part of the city, it's not investing in another part of the city because it has finite resources. So we look at sort of the interaction between all of these elements, and we don't, you know, we don't try to lay blame heavily on any one thing. We don't try to attribute that. We want to be more, looking to the future and more positive and saying that, okay, you know, we all know that we're in a bad state here, but to come back, we all need to start coordinating our action and really making concerted and targeted investments.
Mac McComas is my guest, along with Matthew Kahn. He's the author of Unlocking the Potential of Post-Industrial Cities. He's part of the Johns Hopkins 21st Century Cities Initiative. If you have a question or comment for Mac, 410-662-8780. Our email here is midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us, of course, at @midday_wypr. And you write, Mac, about the dichotomy or the choice that some people see, which perhaps is a false choice, of either growing the urban pie or making an argument for simply redistributing the pie that's already fixed, a sort of zero-sum approach. What's the consensus about the potential to grow the pie, to make, you know, to simply make the pie big enough to accommodate any new industries, any new job markets and labor forces that may arise, as opposed to, you know, if we're going to accept the reality that the pie isn't going to really get considerably bigger, so we're going to just have to move the pieces around that are already in there.
Yeah, so given that Baltimore has had huge job losses and slow business growth in recent years, we're saying that if the city is able to make investments in real estate, improve the environment, improve the schools, there has to be a significant amount of job and business growth. But at the same time, that business growth and that growth in jobs should benefit everybody in the city. You know, we don't want what has happened in Seattle and New York City and San Francisco, where you see some huge growth in businesses and jobs in recent decades, but you also see that, you know, that really just benefited a select few. We don't want that to happen in Baltimore. So we're trying to think about how economic development can really benefit everybody in a city rather than just, those high income earners.
Of course, New York's been New York for a long time. So have large cities like Los Angeles, even, you know, Houston, some of the bigger, you know, Chicago, some of the bigger cities in the country. A place like Seattle experienced incredible exponential growth with the arrival of Microsoft and Amazon. And those two companies alone have really transformed the profile of Seattle. They've made it a much more expensive place to live, and they have just increased the tax base and the resources there exponentially. Is that kind of path to growth and path to prosperity duplicable? You know, can we duplicate that in a town like Baltimore or any of the other places that you looked at? I mean, is it solely dependent on particular industries coming in and, you know, just really transforming the economic landscape? Are there different ways to get there than Seattle got there?
So, you know, I don't think it has to be one or two or a small handful of companies that thrive. But I think there does have to be some sort of local competitive advantage. So one of the cities we look at, Pittsburgh, has done, you know, a little bit better economically than some of the other cities we look at. And a lot of that is because of their advantage in the robotics and AI industry coming out of some of the local universities like Carnegie Mellon. So when you think about, you know, what sort of unique advantages does Baltimore have? It's got a thriving biotech and sort of healthcare startup system. It's got excellent software companies. It's you know, got great proximity to DC and the capital and federal research organizations there. So, you know, I think what's important is identifying sort of what the unique competitive advantages of any one city is, and trying to use those to grow the economic pie.
You write that Baltimore has one of the highest rates of black-owned businesses in the country. That's an interesting data point. Are black-owned businesses, but then on the other hand, we read that, for example, black-owned businesses were much less helped by the payroll protection plan that was one of the first tranches of COVID relief that Congress passed. How do black-owned businesses fare when it comes to, you know, opportunities and access to capital, and how are they doing compared to their Caucasian counterparts?
Yeah, so this, again, this is something we focus on the book because we think it really is unique to Baltimore. And we think if we could invest more in black-owned businesses, that this would be one of the keys to revitalizing the city's economy. So as you mentioned, Baltimore has one of the highest shares of black-owned businesses of any city in the U.S., and that's around almost 50% of the businesses are black-owned. But black-owned businesses make up only 10% of employer firms in the city, and they have less than 4% of the total revenue of all employer firms. So really, there's huge potential that if we were able to invest in these businesses, there could be the potential for significant growth. But as you mentioned, that, you know, and we saw this through the PPP program, is that there's a real disconnect between the traditional financial system and you know, sort of investments in black-owned businesses. And a couple of economists, Alicia Robb and Robert Fairley, have studied racial disparities in access to capital nationwide, and they found that even after controlling for credit scores, black-owned businesses are less likely to obtain the capital they need. And they also found that black-owned businesses report being three times more likely to fear loan application rejection than their white counterparts. So there's a real historic problem here where, you know, the financial system, not only in Baltimore, but nationwide, has done significant harm to black-owned businesses and black homeowners through, you know, things like redlining and just denial of loans. So part of the solution here is trying to figure out new models of lending that will help address some of the challenges. And there's some great work being done in the city. Baltimore Community Lending is an organization that has started up, and they're focusing lending on small minority and women-owned businesses, but they don't allow, or they don't necessitate collateral for their loans. So, you know, if you're a business owner and you don't have a house to take a loan out against, but you need, say, a refrigeration unit to start up a restaurant, they'll be able to connect you to that loan, whereas a traditional bank wouldn't be able to do that.
Yeah, and they just use different criteria to judge the, you know, the creditworthiness of various people. We're going to talk a little bit about that with Ethan McLeod and Melody Simmons of the BBJ in just a minute. But you also mentioned that given the pandemic and what has happened to commercial real estate around the country, perhaps creates an opportunity for Baltimore, because companies that are based in expensive cities like LA and New York are finding that their workforce can work from home. And if that's the case, perhaps they would be interested in moving to cities like Baltimore, where the cost of living is just considerably more reasonable. I mean, do you think that's a realistic opportunity for us?
Yeah, and we've certainly seen it happen, you know, where a lot of companies have shifted a significant amount of their workforce to, you know, other lower cost areas. You've seen a lot of movement out of San Francisco to, say, Austin or Denver or Salt Lake City. But I think there's a even more potential in looking at places like Philadelphia and Baltimore, not only because they're even cheaper real estate in these cities, but because they're on the Northeast Corridor. So, you know, the future of remote work isn't so much that everybody who can do work remotely is going to be remote 100% of the time. The more common experience is that, you know, people are going to be in the office a couple days a week, and then, you know, maybe 3 or 4 days work remotely. So, you know, if a business can, you know, headquarter in Baltimore and have a smaller office footprint, you know, people can live in the city and sort of either go into work there, or, you know, there's potential in living in Baltimore and commuting to DC or other areas for work. And this is where the city's relatively cheap housing comes in as an asset.
You write about racial discrimination in labor markets and the urban labor market demand aspect of any economic growth. A lot of people say, you know, we have all these young kids or young people, particularly people of color, who are out of work, they're looking for work. There's so much to do in the city, so much that needs to be cleaned up, so many blighted properties which need to be taken down, you know, parks need to be maintained, et cetera. Is it as simple as that? People are saying if we're going to use the stimulus money, for example, that is on the way to Baltimore, some $670 million, we should just simply hire people, particularly young people, to do that kind of work. I mean, it seems simple. Is that a feasible plan to raise employment levels among communities of color?
So I think there are a couple key questions here, and it's really about sustainability. So is this just going to be sort of a one-off program where you pay people, you know, $15 an hour to clean up the streets, but then in a year they're back to being unemployed? So there's that question, but then there's also the question of sort of career pathways and business development. So if the city could use this as an opportunity to not only provide job and work experience, but sort of think about, okay, well, how can we also you know, sort of train and provide resources so that some of these folks could start up their own business after this program expires. So I think, you know, giving that real world experience is important, but I think it needs to be more sustainable in terms of developing long-term skills and making sure that this just isn't a sort of one-off.
And as we wrap up here, you're right that the medium level of Black wealth is less than 12% of that of white families. You know, the stock market's gone through the roof over the last year. 61% of white families are invested in the stock market, only 31% of Black families nationwide invested in the stock market. As long as there is such an acute racial wealth gap, what is the key to, and is that going to be a huge deterrent to sustained economic growth in the business sector?
Yeah, so that's a real and significant challenge. And a lot of that, again, has to do because with things like the world of venture capital investors being mostly white, being mostly male, and being mostly Harvard and Yale and sort of Ivy League educated. So again, there's a lot of great work being done in Baltimore about sort of expanding opportunities to invest in not only Black-owned startups, but you look at something like Walbrook Junction, which allowed community members to invest in real estate development in the city. So I think we need to be more imaginative about creating opportunities for regular citizens who don't, might not be as familiar with the stock market or sort of venture capital investing, to have opportunities to invest in projects that they see and businesses that they see coming up and growing in their city.
Mac McCombs, along with Matthew Kahn, he's the author of Unlocking the Potential of Post-Industrial Cities. Max, thanks so much, and congratulations on the book. I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Tom.
Coming up on the other side of a quick break, Melody Simmons and Ethan McLeod of the Baltimore Business Journal will join me. We'll talk about some hopeful signs of investment in several of our underserved communities. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stick around.
You're tuned to 88.1 WYPR.